Hi, we'll open the public hearing this morning for the Department of Education Operations and Grant and Aid. But first, we're going to hear some public testimony from, we have some people who want to say a few things about the student leadership budgets, I assume. So if you could come up, if you want to testify, is there in the back? Anybody else? Do we have some students? I see some students with jackets on. Now's your big chance. Don't be bashful. Sir, take a seat, please. If you would you state your name for the record?
I'm Jerry Betker.
Okay, proceed.
Jerry Betker, owner of Westman Nursery out of Hermiston. I appreciate your efforts in addressing our budget shortfall. I understand it's not an easy job, particularly this year. But please, do your best to uphold Oregon's educational excellence. I have two daughters in FFA under the student leadership. My first exposure to this program was 4 years ago when my older daughter was a freshman. I've been amazed both at the opportunities of this program and the students' willingness to participate. Shannon, my oldest daughter, participated in two presentation teams at National Convention. She was second in the state this year at public speaking and is now serving as a state officer. She's been to Washington, D.C. twice to participate in leadership conferences. Last year at Thanksgiving time, she attended the National 4-H Convention in Atlanta. Just before she left, we received a letter from National 4-H. It stated that they were sorry, but all of her speaking spots were full. I asked her, what's this about? She said, well, I wrote and asked if I could address the convention. 3,000 people. This from a girl who was a preschooler who was too shy to talk to our customers as she played in the nursery aisles. Her younger sister is following close behind. I'm a believer. Give the students help an opportunity, and they will make the best of it. As you know, not only does the Student Leadership Development Center facilitate the activities of 4,500 FFA members, in everything from parliamentary procedure, wildlife habitat, to the issues debate, but it also is the basis of six other student leadership organizations. I understand that cutting 20% from the budget is huge. Cut 20%, cut 30% from this program, but don't destroy the state basis that holds the program together. As I've said before, these are not the kids that you will be funding the Department of Corrections for. Probably not the Department of Human Services either. These are resourceful, energetic individuals who will be actively pursuing the economic and social development of Oregon. Don't sell Oregon short. Continue the commitment to educational excellence. Allow the Student Leadership Center to continue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, would you state your name, please?
I'm Carrie Betker from the Hermiston FFA chapter. As a 4.0 student, freshman co-president, and the green hand president of my FFA chapter, I'm here today to share with you my belief in FFA. In the less than 1 year that I have been involved in FFA, the opportunities presented to me have been endless. The year began with the opportunity to be a leader, to set an example for the students around me. I ran for green hand president and was elected. My first opportunity as Green Hand President was to participate in the district leadership camp. At this camp, I had the opportunity to expand my horizons, to make new friends, to develop new leadership skills with the help of the state officer team. We also had the opportunity to compete in the rituals contest with my fellow officers. We placed first, coming from a group who at first was scared to do this speaking contest. We grew to be confident and again placed first. A few weeks later, the freshman class began to learn the creed. As the freshmen learned the first paragraph, the second paragraph, the third paragraph, they grew from shy freshmen into freshmen that could confidently speak of their beliefs in agriculture. I competed in the chapter contest, but because I forgot a paragraph, I didn't place. However, one of my best friends placed first in the contest. She, who was scared to even give her creed in front of the class, went on to compete at the district level. After this, I had the opportunity to compete in ag sales. My first sales presentation was not good. I stumbled through it, but with the help of hours of community members who helped me to grow confident and to believe in my product, I went on to be second highest sales presentation in the state. Our freshmen also competed in parliamentary procedure career development event. In this, our freshmen learned to discuss an issue both for and against it and the rules of parliamentary procedure. We went on to compete at the district and sectional level. At the same time, I was working on extemporaneous speaking. In extemp, I had a list of 30 topics. I researched each one of them, put together a book. Then, at contest time, I drew a topic and wrote a 4 to 6 minute speech on this topic. I had the opportunity to compete at state. It was awesome, the speaking level that those students were at. I didn't place, but I had the opportunity to watch each of these FFA members and their speaking abilities go on, and they have inspired me to continue with my speaking. I also had the opportunity at state convention to participate in agriculture issues. In ag issues, we developed a presentation on the issue, a 15-minute presentation on an issue. Then we presented it to local forums or to local groups, and then we had to answer 5 minutes of questions on it. Our team of 7 individuals went on to win state and are well-informed on bull trout recovery, not even the typical cows and plows topic, but its critical, critical habitat and dealing with environment. I also had the opportunity to participate in shop skills, not the usual thing for a girl to participate in, but it was lots of fun, and I learned a lot. I have also had the opportunity to participate in Animal Circus, where we shared with the elementary school students the animals, which they otherwise would not be able to see. FFA has given me every opportunity, but for the 4,500 other FFAers in the state, it has given them the same opportunities. Not just the farm kids, but the kids in the cities. Less than 1/4 of FFAers actually live on farms. In FFA, you have the opportunity to participate in any career development event you want, from public speaking to showing steers. Anything you can imagine, there's a CDE for it. You also have the opportunity to participate in a supervised agriculture experience. This is as big as you can imagine it, from kids who go to Alaska to work on fishing boats in the summer, to kids who show a steer, they create their own SAE. There's leadership opportunities, endless leadership opportunities. At National Convention, you have the opportunity to attend many leadership conferences. My sister was able to go to the Washington Leadership Conference in Washington, D.C., and she was truly inspired and motivated and came back and made Hermiston FFA chapter a better chapter. FFA is a place where people who don't usually fit in can find a place. Last week at the Shop Skills Contest, a kid who doesn't have a lot of friends, who's never really succeeded, competed in the Shop Skills, placed first in both of his contests. But you know what he said? He said, "I can't believe I waited so long to start hanging out with FFA kids." FFA kids truly are different. They truly are the inspiration and motivation of Oregon. The data is there. Students involved in the FFA program do better on state assessments. They are more likely to continue on to secondary or to college, and they also are more likely to lead a successful career. The Student Leadership Center provides statewide guidance for this FFA program. They look over the CDE's state fair, which is one of the strongest traditions of agriculture. Without the Student Leadership Center, we would be lacking that statewide guidance. The Student Leadership Center also is responsible for guiding the state officer team, a team of 6 individuals who serve FFA for 1 year. My sister was elected to the officer team this year, and you know what her biggest concern was? She said, "Mom, I only have 1 year to serve these kids. How am I going to make a difference in their lives?" That is the spirit of FFA. We are striving to make a difference in each of the FFA's lives. Student Leadership Center only costs $756,000 every 2 years. For this small amount of money, it is affecting huge numbers of Oregon students. It seems to me that it would be counterproductive to cut this effective program, then try to implement more costly programs to keep the students involved and successful. In the midst of every difficulty, there is an opportunity. In the midst of this budget crisis, I have had the opportunity to come before you and share with you my beliefs about FFA and how many opportunities it has given me and others around the state. In the midst of this difficulty, you also have an opportunity. You have the opportunity to show Oregonians that you care about our future, support FFA and the Student Leadership Center, and help us to remain successful.
Thank you very much. Yeah, next speaker, please.
Yes, my name is Dan Dorn. I'm also from Hermiston, Oregon, and if only I could speak as well as these FFA students. I drove over last night hoping to be able to speak just for a moment in front of this subcommittee, so first of all, thank you very much for taking the time to listen to our comments. I have four children. Three of them are involved in FFA and officers in two different school districts, so my perspective on FFA is a little bit different. I am able to watch the progress at different levels. I also have a middle school student who is in leadership roles in two other programs, school programs. So I'm very, very lucky to watch them come up through. Also, the ability to watch the different types of school supported and activities through athletics and through leadership programs such as FFA, you get to compare them very, very much on a one-on-one basis. And if the OSAA could operate on a $750,000 budget to the level that the Leadership Council does, I think we'd all be millions of miles ahead. And I'm not knocking the OSAA, but it's also a body that is fighting for the same dollars that the Leadership Council is. I sit on the county fair board, and they're also looking for dollars. But I'm not there testifying in front of that group of people. My priority is for the student leadership. It's a group of people that gives direction, and it's a base that doesn't need to be totally destroyed. I'm pretty sure that everyone that testifies in front of you said, yes, cut it. Cut it if you need to. But don't do away with it. It's a base that's been built, and it's a base that has a purpose for all of the students. Yes, we take advantage of it in Eastern Oregon, maybe a little more than downtown Portland in our way. But they also take advantage of it. It's a statewide program that for a very minimal amount of dollars gives a lot of direction to a lot of people. Each one of these programs, FFA, the SBAs, all of the student leadership programs fight for dollars on a community basis. We are always out in the middle of our communities asking for handouts. We do not need to be in that same position for a statewide leadership program. It's just like each member of these subcommittees go out and during election process solicit funds for their elections. How would you like to have to come to Salem and ask the people in Salem, now that you have a central leadership, to fund this building each year? We do that every day with every one of our programs, and the more that the educational dollars shrink, the more the communities have to pick it up. And you know what? They're willing to do that because they see the results of the kids that they are producing. They are leaders, and they are the leaders of the communities. And thank you again for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much. I think your words are well taken in front of this committee, and I appreciate you coming traveling all these miles to make a very important point. Yeah, a lot of us are familiar with the programs and or even participated in them as youth. And so, and as Senator Messerly has too, and he's not here. Great. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may say to the young woman, your comments, your presentation was very thoughtful and in fact wonderful. As you can see, there are a number of vacancies up here. One of them is waiting for you.
Yeah. Yes, very good.
She just told me this morning she's prepared to be the chief of staff for the president.
More power.
She's on her way.
Okay, we're going to proceed with our... we have another person wanting to testify. I didn't see you walk up.
I promise it'll be short.
That's okay.
My name's Mike Williams. I teach ag science at Jervis, just down the road here a ways.
Ooh, absolutely.
And I brought two FFA members with me today. We were down at Oregon State University along with about 750 to 850 other FFA members from across the state. competing at the state level in contests yesterday and today. And we were planning on being down at Oregon State for a college tour today when we heard about this meeting, and we thought that it was appropriate for us to be here. So we thank you for your time. The youngsters I want to talk about today for just a couple of minutes, I brought two with me, and they chose not to speak because not everybody in FFA chooses to maximize on the leadership that you've seen demonstrated here on so many occasions. Examples I'd like to bring to your attention, quite frankly, are the young men that I brought with me, who have, in the last 2 weeks, spent 40 hours outside of the regular school day working on mathematics and science to be able to compete in the state ag mechanics contest. And this was by choice, an extra easy 40 hours over the week and weekend. Now, that's kind of impressive in and of itself. I talk about applied academics and no children left behind. We've got youngsters that are choosing to stay not only up with their crowd, but move ahead of the crowd. If it was just that 40-hour set of overtime, it would be impressive, but they spent the 2 weeks before that, along with about 15 to 20 of their other members, spending another 50 hours or so in 2 weekends getting ready for a banquet in which they had to do everything from prepare the meal to do all the presentations and everything else. And these are youngsters that don't particularly care to be in front of people, but they chose to do the job right. And that crew that I had working on that banquet, I had one youngster that we couldn't have done the banquet without who had a parole officer. And I've got another youngster that we couldn't have done the banquet without who can't even survive in the regular student body, so he's in our special, in our alternative school program. And the only time he comes into the student body is to take agriculture science classes, and he's active in FFA. We've got a lot of youngsters that aren't here today because they're overwhelmed by the fear of being here, that are reached by the programs like FFA, FBLA, DECA, VICA. We're reaching a population of kids, and we're giving meaning to the academics that they get in all their other classes. None of that, the immediate reward, what I call the video game mentality, we can't give them those immediate awards for the knowledges and the skills that they are picking up in our agriculture science classes and our FBLA classes and our clubs without the coordination and the direction that we get from the Student Leadership Center. That's a cold, hard reality. Another reality that comes with this is the fact that we've got, I would bet that we're one of the few programs that you have an opportunity to affect that not only require money but create money, something in the vicinity of about $500,000 a year in matching funds come in from industry and other organizations. That goes away without the help of the help and the coordination of the Student Leadership Center. And I'll be honest with you, I'm not even going to get into the amount of volunteer time that comes from teachers like myself, parents like those that you saw here earlier today, that are all made, encouraged and made possible by the direction of the Student Leadership Center. For my own personal health, I don't want to deal with the overtime that I put in, the overtime that I choose to put in because of the help that I get from the Leadership Center. These are things that are directly affected by your decision. People that are willing to work way beyond the job description, people that are willing to work in spite of their own job descriptions that create the livelihood for their families. And think about the youngsters that aren't the speakers as well as you move forward with your decision. And I'll be honest with you, I do not envy you that decision. But we've got quite a diverse crowd that we're serving with the help of the Student Leadership Development Center. Thank you for considering it seriously.
Thank you for coming today. We appreciate that very much. And as you can see, I have my agriculture FFA cup wallet. I had the good fortune to speak at their annual awards banquet a couple weeks ago, and it was one of the highlights of my this session of the legislature. I was escorted so with such good manners by these students in the program, and I was just treated with the utmost respect and dignity, and I really appreciated that. Okay, we're going to continue with our public hearing. The chair has asked me to let members know if we can finish with our public testimony part this morning from the Department of Education. We won't have to meet this afternoon. And I know several of us on this committee have another committee that's meeting this afternoon to pass budgets in the human services part of our budget, so we'll try to, if we could possibly limit our questions, and maybe if you have something that is a burning, we can ask that and then meet with the people afterwards. So with that in mind, I'm going to call Rick Latour up so he can finish his presentation on the student services. And if you could tell us on what section and page you are in the book, that's always helpful.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Latour. I'm the Interim Associate Superintendent for the Office of Student Services. Yesterday we stopped, I believe, on page 8, which was an outline, a three-year outline of funding for the No Child Left Behind grants. At yesterday's hearing, we were asked to bring back information on two areas by the chair. One was a breakout of the administrative and program cost that stayed at the Department for Operations, and that's been provided to you on the top of your binder, I believe.
Yeah.
Would look like this.
Right.
Looks very much like the one that's on the screen, except what you'll see down the middle is a breakout of on the administrative cost, and those represent both administration and program cost, and the percentage of that. The percentages are actually established within the law, and so that's why you see a variance, for example, as little as a slight fraction over 1% for Title I, going as high as 25% for Title X, the homeless program. And that's primarily set by the federal government based on their assumption of what the state activities will be.
Awesome.
The other issue that we were asked to address yesterday was that I had begun my testimony by indicating that we had gotten as late as Friday updates on budgets. And we were asked by the committee to articulate where those changes were. There are actually three. The rest of them remained the same. There are slight increases to Title I-D, neglected and delinquent, and slight increases to homeless. The most significant increase is in the largest program, which is at the top of the page, Title I. I've placed the increase that we received on Friday in parentheses, and I want to explain why I did that. The original estimate for next year was $106 million. The estimate that we got on Friday indicates that Oregon may be receiving $115 million. I am cautious about that for two reasons. Number one, there already appear to be significant errors in the document. There's some census errors in several of the counties, and until I've resolved those, I'm not certain that these figures will hold. The second is that while we haven't had an opportunity to analyze the formulas completely, I did yesterday afternoon take the dozen largest districts receiving funding and took a look at what had happened to them. What is the most informative about this new allocation figure is that it is going to be based for the first time on the 2000 census. The Title I grant is based primarily on Oregon poverty census, and the 2000 census is going to come into place for the first time this year, or next year with that allocation. What we found in looking at the 12 largest districts is, although Oregon, and we're gratified to see that Oregon is scheduled to receive a 21%+ increase as a state, of the 12 largest districts, two of them will actually receive less funding next year. Four of them will receive approximately level funding, and six will receive more funding, with two of them receiving more than 70% more funding. So what this preliminary allocation indicates to me is that while it's wonderful that Oregon appears to be receiving slightly more dollars, the funding is going to be redistributed and will have a fairly profound effect on local school districts. With many of them losing money, others staying level and not participating or benefiting from the increase, and others gaining significantly from that increase.
Yeah. Questions from the committee about that?
Please identify the districts for us. If not today, if you could get that information to us in writing, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I can actually provide that to you now. I would suggest that the reason I'm not naming specific districts is our protocol, especially for districts that lose funding, has been to contact them individually and inform them and talk with them about what we see as the formula issues and what their options are. We haven't done that yet because we just received it on Friday, but we've had to make that available to you.
Do we know why that formula has been rigged the way it has?
Madam Chair, quite clearly the 2000 census has accounted for shifts in population in the in Oregon. There have been communities that have gained in substantially in numbers, but not in poverty students, and because it's a ratio, that changes their amount. There's a significant shift in demographics in the state and the location of the demographic populations in the state. Both of those would contribute. It's largely because of the 2000 census update. One of the things to keep in mind about the 2000 census is an anomaly or an unfortunate factor, which was it was done in April of 2000 in Oregon, which was just before the economy was actually still fairly good at that point. Had it been taken 6 months later, we probably would have had quite a different picture.
Any further questions or comments?
No, ma'am. I like to see the data.
Yeah, you like to see the data.
We will provide that to you today. I actually have a copy in my briefcase.
Thank you. And go ahead and continue, please.
Going to the next slide. This is the results. This will complete my my comments on the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, or the No Child Left Behind legislation. I want to talk briefly, and I know we're running short on time, so I'll be very brief. I want to talk briefly about some of the accomplishments. Number one, I want to suggest that the major change in federal programs in the last 8 years has been 8 years ago when we designed federal programs, we designed them as individual programs, and we asked children to fit into the program. What we now do is we design from the sense of who are the children to be served, and then we design the program to fit the children. This has allowed us also to make programs work together. An example is, although we receive less than $1 million in homeless education money, Title I-A funding actually contributes more than $1.5 million to homeless children throughout the state because the two programs work closely together. Second, Oregon federal program model programs have been a model, and in fact were actually reflected in the new law. If I might, I want to point out one of those that I suggested yesterday is actually scheduled for elimination in 04, and that's Title I-F, which is the low-performing schools or school improvement grant. Our school improvement grant, which shorthand is called the Comprehensive School Reform Initiative, 8,000 schools were funded in the year 2000 or 1999-2000 under this, and last year the Department of Education recognized 38 of those nationally as what were called promising sites. Of those 38, 8 of them were in Oregon, fully almost one quarter of the schools recognized as making significant progress using this funding were in Oregon. And then finally, the question was asked yesterday about the opportunity to eliminate the paperwork that's often associated with federal programs. 4 years ago, for the programs that you have listed on the previous page and that I've articulated, there would have been a separate application for each of those programs. In the last 4 years, what we have done is moved to a single application for any of the formula programs, and therefore the districts are not having to jump through individual hoops and different methodologies. It also provides an opportunity to see how the programs work together instead of as individual programs. That concludes my discussion on No Child Left Behind programs. I would like to take a very brief few minutes. I have only two slides on the next program, which is our funding for the Healthy Kids Learn Better partnership. This is a cooperative agreement. I want to take a moment to explain that a cooperative agreement is more in the form of a contract than it is in the form of a grant. What it means is that the Centers for Disease Control, working with the U.S. Department of Education, has determined activities that they would like to see done. They offer that to states. If states see that as being a part of their mission, they're welcome to apply. Oregon did that 2 years ago, and we determined that we would apply. We were one of 18 states that received funding. This is a competitive grant. The partnership is largely based around a fairly simple concept. Many children in Oregon face challenges in our schools that are associated with more than the quality of their math and reading program and the quality of the education, their instruction, which is certainly important. But many of them face barriers related to social, emotional, and physical well-being. And many, many organizations, individuals, and entities and agencies in the state are very committed to working on behalf of those children and their health and well-being. What this grant allows us to do is to create a partnership to ensure that all of those programs are informed about a common set of goals. For the last 2 years, we've been working on that and recently produced a blueprint for action, which includes 10 significant areas of action that will be undertaken during the course of this grant, which actually will run through the next 5 years. We were reauthorized in March. You can see that the funding for the next biennium is $1,700,000 approximately, and that it does fund 5.4 positions at the Department of Education. Those positions and their work are specifically outlined within the cooperative agreement. On the following slide, what you see is a schemata of the partners that we have so far been working with. There are over 80 partners, all working on behalf of children and their health and well-being. This program has been amazingly successful so far, and we anticipate that it will continue to be so. Any questions on that?
Any questions from members?
With that, I'd like to, with the chair's permission, ask that Dr. Joyce Doherty, who is the director of our child and school nutrition program, come and present to you on the child nutrition programs in the Office of Student Services.
Please do. Ms. Doherty, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, for the record, I am Joyce Doherty, Director of the Child Nutrition and Food Distribution Programs.
Pardon me, ma'am. Could you pull the microphone a little closer? I'm not hearing too good
okay.
These days.
How's that? Our vision is that all Oregon children are well-nourished, ready to learn, and able to make lifelong healthy food choices. The child nutrition programs are located within the Office of Student Services. We support 21.05 FTEs. There are currently 19 staff in the child nutrition programs. We also support a 0.25 FTE for civil rights and a 0.80 FTE for accounting and claims. I will now provide some information on the child nutrition programs. In 2002, the child nutrition programs generated approximately $98 million for our state in the form of meal reimbursement and commodity food distribution. This slide illustrates revenue sources that support child nutrition. In department operations, we have three funding sources: general funds, other funds, and federal funds. We receive $176,000 of general funds. This is a mandatory match. We also receive $310,000 of other funds. This is a revolving account for the commodity food distribution program, and over $4 million in federal funds from the United States Department of Agriculture. In the next biennium, we expect to administer over $193 million entitlement dollars. Entitlement dollars are federal funds that are guaranteed and unlimited. These funds provide reimbursement to sponsors for meals served. The child nutrition programs are a collection of federally funded programs that provide nutritious and low-cost meals to all children. These funds provide cash reimbursement and donated food assistance to public and private schools, residential child care institutions, and child and adult daycare centers under agreement to the United States Department of Agriculture. This graphic shows the distribution of funds among our primary activities: administration, school nutrition, and community nutrition. 2% of our funds are used to administer the child nutrition programs, according to federal regulations. Activities using these funds include monitoring, providing technical assistance, and training to program sponsors. School nutrition funds cover the National School Lunch Program, the School Breakfast Program, the After School Snack Program, the Special Milk Program, and the Food Distribution and Commodities Program. Community nutrition funds include child and adult care, the Child and Adult Care Food Program, the Summer Food Service Program, the At-Risk Snack Program, and the At-Risk Supper Program. I am proud to say that Oregon is one of seven states, the only state west of the Mississippi, that offers this program. Our administrative activities are funded from three sources: state general funds, federal funds, and other funds. The majority of financial support comes from federal funds. As I mentioned earlier, the general fund monies represent the required maintenance of effort to administer the programs. Other funds support the administrative functions of the commodity food distribution program. School meals provide for the nutritional needs of school-aged children, ensuring their readiness to learn. School nutrition programs were federally legislated in 1946 when President Harry Truman signed the National School Lunch Act, quote, as a measure of national security to safeguard the health and well-being of the nation's children and encourage the consumption of nutritious agricultural commodities. Community nutrition programs were federally legislated in 1968 with the creation of the Child Care Food Program and the Summer Food Service Program. Today's community nutrition programs provide children from birth through 18 the opportunity to eat a nutritious breakfast, lunch, snack, or supper anytime throughout the year. These programs address the nutrition needs of children outside of school and serve as part of the national infrastructure to address the hunger needs of children so they can attend school ready to learn. Even though the average number of children that participate in our programs on a daily basis has increased, one in four children live in a food insecure household. That is, these children are at risk of going hungry. Unfortunately, Oregon continues to lead the nation in hunger. Child nutrition programs help alleviate hunger and improve nutrition for preschool and school-aged children. These programs make nutritious meals available to all children, ensuring readiness to learn and success at every grade level. Thank you. This concludes my shortened presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Doherty. Are there any questions? We appreciate your presentation today and all realize how important it is for these children to receive these programs.
Thank you.
Next on the list is Anita McClanahan, Early Childhood Education. Please.
Good morning, members of the committee, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Anita McClanahan, Director of Early Childhood Programs for the Oregon Department of Education. My first slide this morning indicates the budget for which I have responsibility in my office, and it needs just a brief explanation. While I introduce myself as the Director of Early Childhood, you know that we're all working on efficiencies within our agency. And so I don't wear as many hats as Bob Seawert, whom you've gotten to know quite well, but I do have a few hats that I put on a regular basis. And the budget represents the responsibilities for a variety of people for whom I have supervision responsibility. My largest amount of budget in terms of the Department Operations General Funds money is the money that pays for the early childhood staff, and there's five members of that staff that receive some of those funds. We are currently down one member due to the hiring freeze. I also have responsibility for the person that does the school counseling and student records. I am the supervisor for that person, so the budget item, his salary and activities are also based in that budget. In the Department Operations federal funds money, that represents the Even Start coordinator, and those are federal funds. I am her currently her supervisor, as well as the supervisor for the Head Start Collaboration Project, which is a federally funded Head Start project. And then I also have supervision responsibility for Winston Cornwall, who is our civil rights officer. And that represents the budget in terms of department operations. The grant and aid responsibilities, the largest portion of that, as you can tell, are the general fund monies, and that represents the budget for the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten. And my presentation today will be based on the budget for the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten. I will not be touching on those other areas of responsibility. The small portion in federal funds represents the Even Start federal dollars that go out in grant and aid. And then the other hat that I wear is that I'm the coordinator for the Teen Parent Child Development Programs. And that's also federal money that comes through the Child Care Division to the Department of Education for the child care centers that are based in our high schools and the teen parent programs that are based in our high schools. We can move to the next slide, but before I discuss that slide, I'd like to set a context for you, and the context is going to be a brief history of the Oregon Head Start pre-kindergarten program. 15 years ago, Oregon was well ahead of the nation in its concern for our youngest children. Our legislature at that time had a compelling vision for Oregon's poorest children, and in 1987 made a promise, which began in 1988, to support these children and their families with comprehensive services in education, child health, disabilities, and parent and community partnerships, with the main objective of preparing these children for school and helping them break the cycle of poverty. Oregon also realized at that time that in order to ensure appropriate child outcomes, Oregon's program must be based on standards. So in 1987-1988, we were already discussing the issue of standards well ahead of the nation's move to that direction. We adopted the federal Head Start program standards for the Oregon model. These standards have a 37-year record of proven child success and outcomes. Our adoption of this federal model has enabled us to form a very unique partnership with the federal government, especially our Region 10 office in Seattle. Our partnership allows us to maximize the resources and services for Oregon's children and families. I want to be sure that we understand that eligibility for this program is based on income. Families that receive the services in Oregon Head Start Pre-Kindergarten may receive no more than 100% of the federal poverty guideline. And for your reference, that amount of money equates to $18,400 for a family of four. To put this in perspective, in 2001-2002, 77% of the families, the children that we served, earned less than $15,000 as their annual income. This income eligibility is lower than children who receive free lunch or lower than families who qualify for WIC. You can tell from this that we are indeed serving the poorest children in our state. A question that's often asked of us is, how does Head Start interface with special education? The program standards require that 10% of the population we serve must be children with disabilities. Currently in Oregon, we are serving 17% of that population within the Head Start program. These children come to us, some of them already diagnosed with disabilities, and some of them are diagnosed within the program. For clarification, we partner with the local early childhood special education providers within the local communities. The Head Start program is the placement site for children who receive special education services. Head Start does not provide the special education service, but rather works with the local partners to implement the strategies for the child that have been designed by the expertise in special education. We provide the support that that special education child needs based on the individualized family plan or child plan that comes with their IEP in special education. It's also important to note that Oregon Pre-Kindergarten serves multiple ethnic populations. This is reflective of our state and the programs at the local level. The demographics of the local level is usually represented within the program. And I was struck by Senator Gordley's question yesterday related to staffing of programs that maybe matched the faces of the children. So I went back to our office and I said, is there any way that we could find out what the staffing pattern is? And we do have in the program information report a question that asks specifically not for management staff, but for those staff that have the frontline face with the children. And I'm pleased to report that 45% of the staff in Head Start are staff of ethnic diversity. So we are trying to maximize that. Some staff that volunteer, we have many people that speak, over 328 folks identified as speaking a language other than English to help our children, but many of those are not fully employed on staff. They come in as volunteers and work with the children. So I know the programs are making a tremendous effort to meet the needs of the children based on their cultural diversity. Now, the slide before you, the map, that's the one we want to look at. I like to use this slide because I think it helps us understand our funding source. In Oregon, when we talk about Head Start, we talk about it as a single system of service with two funding streams. We have the state funding stream and we have the federal funding stream. An analogy that might help you picture this is if you can envision the Columbia River and think about where the John Day comes in, and then think about where the Sandy comes in, and then go back in your vision and look at the Columbia, you only see one river. You cannot pluck out the waters of the John Day, and you cannot pluck out the waters of the Sandy. You have one system of water that floods itself out to our sea. This is true in Head Start. We have two funding streams, but within the program it is a single system of service. This is very unique in the nation, and it is because of the relationship and partnership that we have with the federal program. What this does is enable us to do many things jointly so that we can maximize the services that we provide. It's important to note that we have services in every county. There are 31 programs in our state with 594 classrooms. In 2001-2003, we actually served 18,000 children in the biennium, 61% of the eligible population. Oregon paid for 42% of the actual children served, and the federal partners paid for 58%. That's what the chart represents for you. 61% is a wonderful target that we've reached, as it appears. It's important to note that some of the children that we serve are not actually counted in the census data. And we have a tremendous waiting list of children. While the census looks wonderful and it looks like we're serving a high percentage of children, we have over 4,000 children income verified in the state, meaning that we know they're eligible. We have another 1,200 children who income has not been verified, and another 1,100 children who may be are $5 or $10 over the income guideline. So we have approximately 6,000 children that are on our list to be served, and we, of course, are meeting 61%, but there's 40% still unserved.
Madam Chair,
I have a question, Senator Gordley.
Thank you. If I could just make a point here, that 61% is significant because it also brings up another promise we made through our Oregon benchmarking system. I believe we set, was it 2003 or 2004, as the goal for when we would serve all of the eligible pre-K children. And so we're falling far short of that. And when you look at the population, this is the most vulnerable population of children in our state. And I appreciate that the governor has prioritized services to children in his budget, and I appreciate that the co-chairs have also prioritized services to children in their budget, but it just does not go far enough. All of these children should be receiving this Oregon Head Start program. That is a failing on our part, and it just makes me angry that we don't do better, because it goes back to the original promise in 1987. We said that these were the children that we were going to save, basically. That was the promise, that we were going to save these children and we were going to save these families, and we're not doing it, and we can do better than this. And I appreciate your leadership, Ms. McClanahan, through the years and continuing to bring this back to us. But again, we've got an Oregon benchmark that says 2004, and we're not going to meet it.
Chair Smith and Senator Gordley, thank you for those comments. And I share your passion and feel very privileged to be a voice for these children and these families. And I value your voice in this as well. It's important that we keep the target before us. The 2004 target does say that we would serve 100%. And I'm encouraged that we haven't lost sight of the target and that we continue to strive to meet that goal. Even if we are not able to meet it at this time, we are striving to meet it, and every little bit does help. And it is important that the governor has kept this in his budget. I concur with that.
Representative Bates, you have a comment?
No, comment and question, Madam Chair. The Head Start program is one we all support, obviously, and I'm going to echo some things you've already heard, but I've got two other concerns and a question that I already show the answer to that I don't. And so I'm going to ask, fill in my ignorance. The funding streams for this are federal and state. Are they matching funds, or is there a correlation between one and the other? And is it the money we put up matched, or is it just come as a grant?
Chair Smith and Representative Bates, the federal program does require a 20% match, and our dollars do match the federal government's funds that come, but it's not a direct correlation. Our program is funded independent of that federal match. It's just that that is a way that programs can meet the minimum required for their federal match. And the state originally designed the Oregon pre-kindergarten program to be able to add additional children with the federal program, but we work in partnership.
Madam Chairs.
And there wasn't even music.
Yeah. The music stops, they all sit
down. They sit down, right.
So I didn't quite get an answer to my question. If we increase the state funds to it, do we also simultaneously increase the federal funds to it, or is that not that closely tied together?
Chair Morgan and Representative Bates, it is not that close a tie. If we increase funds, that's not a guarantee of increased federal funds. The federal funds will come to us as a state allocation based on expansion dollars. And currently, there's no anticipation of federal expansion dollars for this next, at least the next year, and possibly the next 2 years. That's the report that we're getting from the federal office right now. So our funds do not correlate to the fact that if we add more money, the feds add more money, like some programs do. What our funds do is allow the current programs that have federal dollars to use the state dollars as their 20% match.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just a quick comment, and the only way you want to get going here. I'm going to echo what the good senator said also. I'm also concerned about what I call the adequacy of the programs. Not that you just serve a lot of kids and get to 100%, but the programs themselves are effective. And I've been long concerned because of lack of funding that you're not running the programs you need to run. There's been some very good studies showing that for real long-term gains you can see in third, fourth, sixth, seventh, eighth grade, we need to have a very intensive Head Start program. And for the most part, because of lack of funding, we don't do that in the state. We do what you have to do with the money you've got available to get as many kids as you can to get them ready for the kindergarten. But you don't do the kind of intensive program that some of these kids could really benefit from. And I would guess you'd probably agree with that statement. and I would like to hear something about that, what that would cost, and see some data on long-term gains for kids as well as Head Start, not just the fact that they seem to be doing better at getting ready for kindergarten. What happens to those kids if you track them through the first 3, 4, 5 years of their education? Do we lose what we've gained in Head Start, or do we maintain? And I don't see that in the documents. If you've got something, I'd like to have it later.
Chair Morgan and Representative Bates, I am going to talk about the outcomes a bit later in my presentation, and I will also discuss some of the long-term benefits, and then I will make a report back to you in terms of longitudinal types of studies. The federal government currently is engaged in a longitudinal study, and there, you are absolutely accurate that there isn't a lot of data that talks about the long-term effectiveness of Head Start as the child moves into the fifth grade or the seventh grade or the eighth grade. That's part of what Oregon would hope to do at least sometime in the future through our student identification and through our database system. And when there is appropriate funding to do that, I'm sure that we will be able to also be able to make a better report. So I'd like to proceed, Chair Morgan, if that's...
Please proceed.
We're going to look at the next slide.
Yes. And just to pick up, just to add to what the good representative has said, there is a bill in the House that would provide funding for Oregon pre-kindergarten programs through community colleges, and it's House Bill 3608. It provides for a sales tax to accomplish that goal. That's just an FYI. Please proceed.
Chair Morgan, Senator Gridley, thank you very much for the FYI. I'm going to go back to my office and look for this. Okay, this slide represents the distribution of the budget for the Oregon Head Start pre-kindergarten. You can tell by the slide that 86.2% of the budget is used directly for the child services portion. This is inclusive of the education, disabilities, and health services, the transportation, and facilities. It's important to remember that the budget that is before you, the cost per child that you're looking at, represents the full cost of the program. Head Start pays for everything in the program. And 13.8% is utilized for the family and community partnerships. I want to define just a little bit about the specialized components within the program that provides the comprehensive services. The education component, which is critical for the future of our children, includes learning centers that are created to stimulate child development, understanding about books, stories, numbers, literacy, all of those things that we're so concerned about. Children also have time to play in dramatic play centers, enjoy art and music. Children are learning to identify letters, hear and discriminate between the sounds and letters, beginning and ending sounds of words, the pre-literacy skills that need to be developed. The Head Start outcomes require that children are evaluated and make progress in their understanding of early literacy and numeracy. And in your binder, I have put a copy of the Head Start performance outcomes for you. And you can see when you have at your leisure time to look that there are certain requirements that children are currently being evaluated on. This is about a 3-year-old program with the Federal Head Start office now. All of our programs are using these standards. We, of course, are abiding by the performance outcomes, and we are evaluating children on their outcomes. While cognitive development in Head Start is essential, it's also critical that children learn how to take turns, that they learn how to be a friend, that they learn how to problem solve. And these early social-emotional developmental stages are so critical, not only for when the child enters kindergarten, but it is the most critical part of our life for lifetime success. Regarding the health services component, 100% of the children are medically screened and referred to treatment if necessary. The role of the Head Start program is to ensure that the children can access the services that they need, the mental health, the dental, the physical, whatever health they need. Across the state, several programs have made arrangements with local medical providers to provide services for the Head Start children at a reduced rate. Many of these children also participate in the Oregon Health Plan. In many instances, doctors and dentists offer their services free for the children with the highest need. We have samples of that across the state.
Madam Chair.
Representative March.
Many participate in the Oregon Health Plan, but they are all qualified if they're at this poverty level. Why? What's the gap here, and why are we spending money here when we should it should be covered under the health plan?
Chair Morgan and Representative March, the programs at every local level try very hard to get every family enrolled. Some families choose not to enroll their children. Some families choose not to participate in the health services that the program does offer. As far as I know, every child whose family wants them to participate, if they have no other resource for medical coverage, they are on the Oregon Health Plan. It's very important to note that the Oregon Head Start Pre-Kindergarten does not pay for the medical services if there is any other resource for the child to be paid for. The monies do not come out of the grant and aid funds. Only as a payer of last resort, if there are no other resources, if there's no other way to make an arrangement with a local physician or a dentist, then the program will pay for the services. But usually it is at a far lesser rate than what most people would pay. It's at a negotiated rate for those children. But the programs have made every effort to enroll all the children who are eligible. One of their main objectives in the health component is to assure that the child has a medical home, that the child will be treated for whatever ailments they have. And many times, there are many children who come to us quite needy, as I'm sure Representative Bates is quite aware in your own area. I wanted to show you just an example of what happens in some programs. This is the Parent Health Handbook, and this happens to be out of Representative Bates' area. It's from Jackson County. And this is a wonderful document that was created within the program, and I know it's distributed to all the families in the program, but I also understand many medical facilities in Jackson County are using this. They put it in the doctor's office. I think, Representative Bates, are you one of those? I see him nodding his head. And it's a wonderful document because it helps the family know how to access the services. And then it also has these wonderful checklists for families to be able to identify, if my child has this, I do that. If these symptoms occur, I do that. And so they're not all rushing off to the emergency room right away. They have ways to look at their children's health themselves.
Why would a parent choose not to enroll their child in the Oregon Health Plan?
Chair Morgan, some families do not believe in medical care and service, and that's the basic reason that they would choose not to do that.
They don't believe in medical care what?
Medical care or service. They, for religious reasons, they don't want to participate.
So why would they take these services as opposed to Oregon Health Plan services?
Chair Morgan, what services? Do you mean the Head Start services? Is that what you're asking?
The child health services in this budget.
They may not take the child health services. They may agree to a screening of their child, but they may not agree to treatment for their child.
Okay.
Another critical...
Madam Chair. My understanding is this: you do screening of, just like the WIC program does screening. You don't do any actual treatment, and you don't actually pay for treatment, I don't believe. But maybe I'm incorrect in that. Is that?
Chair Morgan and Representative Bates, that you are correct. We do the screening. We do not treat the children. We access the services where treatments are available. We are not doctors. We have a health coordinator within the program, and they work within the community to access the services, and we do only pay as a payer of last resort. If there are no other resources and a family needs service, the program will pay for that.
Do you have any idea how many of the children that are involved in these screening services are actually also involved with the Department of Human Services in some way?
Chair Morgan, I don't have that statistic, but I will ask that question and see if there's any way that we can track that. Within every local community, we coordinate all of the services with the Department of Health and Human Services, where there's strong community partnerships, and that's the next part of my comment is around the idea of community partnerships with the Commission on Children and Families and the Oregon Children Plan that was passed in the last biennium. The Oregon Head Start programs are represented at every county level in the early childhood team. And the objective of that is that programs work together so there are non-duplicative services. It doesn't necessarily mean that someone from DHS might not be consulting with the family, but it's done in a coordinated way with other programs that are interfacing with the family, with the objective being that we maximize the resources and that we are non-duplicative in our response to the family's needs. And I can find for you, at least I will research and see if there's any statistics that will help us know how many families we serve that maybe also may be in some way involved with the Department of Human Services. And I will try to get that back to you tomorrow.
Follow up? Madam Chair, I'm still a little uncertain. You do screening, and then you said it's your pair of last resort for some health care issues. Two questions here. I think it's 833,000. I assume that's what your budget for this is. Do you attempt to get federal fund match for that for the Medicaid program? And two, if you are a payer of last resort, it indicates that you actually are paying for services to some of these kids. I don't know how much of that money goes to that, but it would seem to me those people most often would probably qualify if they were in health fund. But I may be wrong. There may be some people above poverty, have no insurance, can't afford it. You're taking care of those people.
Chair Morgan and Representative Bates, we do try to access all available medical services for the child. Some of our children do receive Medicaid services. And it is accurate to say that there are some children that are above the poverty level. In some cases, there are very few. Most of the children, as we've looked at our data, that qualified for the program who are above poverty are children who are there because they qualified for special education services. And they may not be the ones accessing the paying of last resort. I will do some research for you and see if I can find any statistics on that. It's not a question that we typically ask in our information report, how much did you pay out for medical expenses, but I can do a quick search on our listserv and ask our programs if they could report that to me, and I'll get that information to you as soon as possible. I think it's quite minimal, any money that we pay.
The Medicaid match question that Representative Bates asked, what do you apply for a Medicaid match for people that you give the services to?
In some cases, Chair Morgan, we do apply for a Medicaid match. It's a very complicated system, but we do. Yes, we do.
So I would assume then if there are patients that are eligible for Medicaid match, they would also be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan?
That's accurate, Chair Morgan.
Then the question that I have is, why are those people not on the Oregon Health Plan?
I don't have the answer for you at this moment. I will have to ask our programs why people who choose not, I know that some choose not to because of religious reasons. I do not know the answer fully to your question, and I will research that as well, Chair Morgan, and get back to you with that.
Could you also bring us a breakout in the child health services area on how much of this goes into the screening part of it and how much goes into service providing? And then the information that you're going to try to get us on the number of families or the percentage of families in the program that also are involved in DHS programs. But I think what we're trying to get to here is to see if there is any kind of savings that can be made by aligning the services more closely with the Oregon Health Plan services and the DHS services.
Chair Morgan, I will be happy to research this for you and get back to you as expediently as possible.
Thank you.
One outstanding example of community partnership I thought was reported to me by one of our Head Start directors in the Lincoln County area. And this director told me that at the end of the Spanish Head, where there's the service industry, housekeeping service industry, that the housekeeping crew staff there decided because of the high need for child care that they would make a voluntary staff a reduction in their salary and a contribution each month specifically for child care. And then the inn manager matched that out of his own personal resources. And on a monthly basis, they provide the Head Start program a check for $1,600 to help defray the cost of child care for children who need a full-day service. And I thought that was quite an outstanding effort on the part of community to help defray cost and support these children. We can move to the following slide, and this is where I'd like to talk about the investment on our return, or the return on our investment. I said that a little backwards. Well, when we talk about the outcomes for children, most specifically, Head Start is designed to prepare the child for school entrance, to enter school ready to learn, and to be on par with their age mates. If you go back to the concept of the children for whom we're serving, the children for whom this program is providing service, they do not have some of the same opportunities that children, even in middle class homes, have. They don't have the books in their homes. They don't have resources to field trips and things that other children have that round out their vocabulary, their sense of the world, and their knowledge. So federal government has a national study that's called the Family and Child Experiences Survey. It's often referred to as FACES. And it's a national study that indicates that we've been doing the study now for 3 years. And the study indicates that in kindergarten, Head Start children are showing substantial gains in early literacy development, word knowledge, letter recognition, vocabulary, and they're also beginning the early math skills. And in Oregon, the one piece of information that we do have that's concrete about the children coming from our Head Start programs into our public school system is the Oregon Kindergarten Readiness Survey. We completed a survey in 2002, and the kindergarten children who participated in Head Start, 82% of them are meeting three critical dimensions of readiness. They're healthy and nourished, they can communicate their needs and wants, and they demonstrate readiness and enthusiasm for new things. There's a massive amount of research, national research, that indicates that investing in disadvantaged children and families early results in a future cost savings. And I know you've heard the future cost savings. They're better educated, they're adjusted, they're contributing adults, and the reduction in remediation in special education, incarceration, and joblessness and homelessness is that's all reduced when children have an opportunity early with their families to be successful. The Children's Defense Fund just published a document, and I put the briefing up, a short two-page, in your packet, and it's the state of Oregon's children. And when they talk about the return on our investment in early childhood, they do say that every $1 invested in quality early childhood care and education saves as much as $7 by increasing the likelihood that children will be literate, employed, and enrolled in post-secondary education and less likely to be school dropouts. I know there's some controversy about that figure, and I also know that every child wouldn't perhaps save the state that kind of money. But I just did a very brief calculation, and I thought about if we have our cost per child is $7,600, and we were going to say $7 on every dollar that we invest, we would be saving $54,000 for every child. And if we multiplied that by the 18,000 children that we served, we're going to have a bucket money of saving. And even if that only applied for half of the children or a third of the children, we would have more than an empty bucket. So the investment is a very wise investment and does indeed, in the long term, save the state money. I'd like to respond back to Representative Bates' question about the long-term effectiveness of Head Start. I did mention that we don't currently have data that can tell us what Oregon's children are doing in the long term. I would also like just to highlight again that the objective of Head Start wasn't the long-term gains, but it was the preparation of the child for school. And then this is where there has to be the transition in partnership with the public school system to carry on the tradition work, the hard work that happened for that child within Head Start. So we have kind of a hand-holding partnership here between the early childhood program and our K-12 system to ensure that what we do in Head Start, which is that link with the family, is maintained when the child enters school, because that's where we make the impact, is when the parents are also involved.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, I would just like to point out that in this document you have provided for us from the Children's Defense Fund, and thank you, there's a line on the reverse side, investments in children, that points out that Oregon spends 3.8 times more per prisoner than per pupils, than per public school pupil. Just thought we'd all like to know.
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, thank you.
We give them all health care, too.
I'd like to go to the last slide. And the last slide talks about our conclusions, and this is the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Grant and Aid budget, looking at it for the year 2003-2005. And the governor's proposed budget is $53.5 million, as you know, and our allocation plan for that money is that $53.2 million of that will go directly out to the programs for the grant and aid, for all the services that I've described in my presentation. We will reserve $300,000 of that for our quality assurance share, and that's the partnership share with our federal government for the quality assurance reviews that we do for the program. We pay according to the percentage of children in a site that are funded by Oregon, and then the federal government pays the percentage for which they fund for the quality assurance reviews. We're projecting that with the current proposed budget, we would be able to fund 6,992 children. That's a reduction in the number of children that we're currently serving, a reduction of 554. As Representative Bates pointed out earlier, it's more important to have a high-quality, comprehensive program and to meet all the requirements in the performance standards than to serve more children than we can provide the services for. And so the Department of Ed and the Head Start Association is committed to maintenance of quality over quantity of children served.
So we're going to fund fewer children. Does that take us below the 61%?
Chair Morgan and Senator Gordy, yes, it does. It will reduce us to a 58% service level. And that is based on the information that we currently have from the federal government. If the federal government provides any additional funds for expansion in Head Start, then our numbers would go up again. But based on the Oregon budget and information that we have regarding federal funds, we do not anticipate serving any more children. So it would be a reduced level to 58% or 57.9% of the targeted eligible population. I really appreciate your time, and I would be happy to answer any more questions that you might have, and we'll provide you with the information that you have requested.
Questions? I do have a question. All of the interaction that I've had with this program over the interim as we've tried to balance budgets, the discussions have always been around cutting access to the program rather than looking for efficiencies within the operation of the program as ways to save money. Can you talk to the committee about what is going on inside the organization of the program to make it operate in a more efficient and cost-effective manner without limiting the number of kids that are coming in, or without that being the first place that you go?
Chair Morgan, I would be pleased to answer that question. And I'm going to go back to the reductions that we took in this last biennium. The programs made every effort to find all of the officials they could specifically not to reduce children. And during this, the budget cuts that we've had during this biennium, we did not reduce the number of children served. But they were short-term sorts of ways that they could look at it. They staff volunteered days without pay. In some cases, the programs were serving over the minimum required days. They had a longer year, and so they reduced some days at the end that was above the minimum required in the performance standard. In some cases, the management staff took unpaid days just as management staff so that they wouldn't have to reduce cut staffing too deeply. And those were ways that they found efficiencies in the short term. Currently, our programs are looking at ways within their budgets that they might, again, find the efficiencies in order not to reduce children. But as it's been reported to us, they have certain staffing requirements that they must meet because of class size ratio. They're looking at if they had three staff in a classroom rather than the minimum requirement of two, is it possible to reduce that third person? And because of the needs of the population, this has to be looked at very carefully. We don't want to jeopardize the ability for children to be successful by cutting too deeply. And so the programs have said to us the actual cut in program is 352 children. However, over the biennium, looking at the number that we served last year for the biennium, the net result is the 554 children. Our programs really, I believe, have made every effort to maximize and be as efficient as possible. They've looked for funding with child care. We have a partnership agreement with child care for those services that provide full-day services for the Head Start programs, and they're helping to cover those kinds of costs. They're looking for community partnerships wherever they possibly can for services to be delivered. And I can, with all integrity, say to you that I truly believe our programs have worked very hard. And we currently are also working with our federal partners to see what other ways that we might be able to find efficiencies within the funding streams that we have. I would also mention, just in closing, in your packet, I did give you a full report of the Oregon Head Start Pre-Kindergarten Program for this biennium. And on the last page of that report, I do highlight some long-range plans and also the kinds of ways that we're looking at for maximizing our program and efficiencies. The last thing I would mention is that we're also trying to work with our school districts who have Title I funds and see if there are any ways that if they want to contribute to Head Start programs that we would be able to utilize some of those funds with our school programs. But
thank you. Further questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will call back Mr. Seward to present to the Committee on Youth Corrections Education and Juvenile Detention Education.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Seward with the Oregon Department of Education, Office of Special Education Programs. The Youth Corrections Education Program and the Juvenile Detention Program that the legislature has established are programs that serve children who are in correctional facilities, either facilities operated by the State Department of Education through the Oregon Youth Authority or by local governments for detention facilities at the county level or local levels, and basically have the general principles, I believe, that the legislature used and talked about as we established these programs were that, first of all, these children, they are still children. They are school-age children that happen to have been adjudicated and wind up in a correctional facility or a detention center, but still are children that need educational programs. I think another principle that was used was that is that one of the ways for children to return to their communities to be cooperative, to be productive as citizens, is to continue their education and to do as well as they can in their education so that that gives them an opportunity to be more successful. I think a third principle is one that I believe Senator Messerly brought up earlier, maybe it was Senator Gordley, that one of the problems that we have in education for children in the public schools is detachment. They get disassociated from the system. Well, these children that are in facilities, correction facilities, are most at risk of being detached and disassociated with their local communities, the local expectations for behavior in their communities, and that we need to address that as they are incarcerated in those facilities and do that through the educational services. I have several slides here, and in the interest of time, I'd like to just kind of move through these very quickly. The legislature has, for several years now, used state school funds to fund these educational programs in both the OYA, correctional facilities, and in detention centers. The funds are generated through the same system, same weights, the same processes that school districts generate the funds. However, the weights are established in statute so that children in the youth corrections education program have availability two weights of state school funds, and for those children in the detention centers have available to them 1.5 weights for each ADM. These funds are then used by the Department of Education as other funds in our budget to enter into contract agreements with local agencies, school districts, educational service districts to provide the educational services to the children that are in these programs and to supervise their education and ensure that there's quality in the educational programs for these children. For the Office of Special Education, the Youth Corrections Education Program, we serve children in 9 facilities around the state. Two of them are here in Salem, one in Salem, Hillcrest, and another in the Woodburn area, McLaren. These children are provided education while they're in resident in those facilities. We provide a full, comprehensive educational program, including all content area requirements, all the requirements under the 21st Century Schools Act, and all the federal requirements for children with disabilities, for children who are neglected and delinquent, and provide as much service as possible. The 7 additional facilities are located around the state, are regional facilities, sometimes referred to as camps. These are systems or situations where children are often relocated out of one of the 2 facilities I mentioned earlier, Hillcrest and McLaren, as they exit the system and begin to return to their local communities. The contractors that we enter into agreements with are provide all the educational service. I'm trying to move along rather rapidly here, so I'm stumbling on my words a little bit. I'm sorry about that. We ask of them to make sure that they comply with all the federal and state requirements about education, that they provide a full educational opportunity for kids, and that they give us monthly reports on their progress with the educational program and ensuring that children receive all the services. I'm going to skip slide 6 because this basically is a report on the cost per students. By the way, you'll notice at the bottom of slide 6, the average cost per student in the Youth Corrections Education Program is around $10,000, a little bit more. This is comparable with children who provide services through the long-term treatment and care programs, for instance, for all basically the same sets of reasons.
It would be good for the committee members to note that these are weighted students at 2 times.
That's right. And so the $10,126 represents 2 weights on a statewide average basis. The cost, by the way, and the reason it's at that level is that we have some of the same issues about serving children in facilities such as these. There are low pupil-teacher ratios. There are needs for equipment and materials, et cetera, in these particular facilities that we purchase and provide, much like we do with long-term treatment care programs. So the costs are a little bit more than what would an average cost of a child in a public school system would be. There are many outcomes from these programs. I believe that we have children leaving these facilities that return to their schools with a better educational status. In other words, we're able to catch many of these kids back up to their grade level status in the academic areas through intensive instruction, intensive training programs. And you see from the slide 7 that we've had very good success with the learning achievements of the children while they're being provided these services. This program has been successful in obtaining a competitive federal grant, by the way, under the Youth Offender Grant Program, where we not only provide a K-12 education but have some federal funds to allow them to participate in higher education. This is a real incentive to the kids, to be real honest with you. They can take and achieve credits community colleges and higher education institutions. It's a lead into future educational growth for them, and hopefully breaks through sort of the barriers of the behaviors that got them there in the institutions in the first place.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordy.
Do these numbers account for all of the students who participated in the corrections education program in the 2001-02 school year?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, these numbers wouldn't represent all of the students that we provide services to, and because many of them are still working on their high school.
Do these numbers account for all of the students who participated in the corrections education program?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I'm still not clear about the question.
Did all of the students in the corrections education program complete it successfully?
Through these numbers.
Are there any students who didn't?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, there are students who are not represented in these numbers. There are ones that are still continuing their education program currently through our contractors, have not graduated, have not obtained a GED at this point, haven't earned higher education credits as yet. So these numbers represent students that have achieved those levels of success.
To get a more complete picture, it would be helpful to know what the total number of students, what is that number? And then as you break out these other categories, we'll have a better sense of who made it and who didn't.
Madam Chair, Representative Gordley, the previous slide, slide 6 at the bottom, does show the total number of children in 2001-2002 that were in programs in the corrections facilities, about 1,100 children. Of those in that year, you'll see these children that achieve certain successes as a result of the educational program. I hope that's responsive.
It's a bit clearer. Well, one of the things that's really clear is that there are a lot of students who are not achieving some educational success while they're incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, these numbers don't represent all the possible successes children may have in these facilities. In other words, all of the children are participating, for instance, in statewide assessments. I don't have the results from the statewide assessments broken down by these particular students, but we certainly could get that data. All children are making succeeding academically as they're being incarcerated and being taught by our contractors.
Okay. Need more information about the total numbers,
mm-hmm.
and what we're counting as success for each person, for each student in the corrections education program.
And Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, I'd be glad to put that together for you and bring it tomorrow, or provide it to your office tomorrow.
Please proceed.
Okay. The next program I'd like to discuss briefly is the Juvenile Detentions Education Program. These detention centers are local, county level. They're for children that are involved with the law and may be placed in detention for a number of days. Our average stay for a child in one of these programs is 4 to 5 days, but sometimes we'll go on for several months depending on the action of the court and the action of the legal officers in the local community. While these children are in these facilities, the state legislature has adopted the policy that these children who are brought into these facilities become resident, basically, of the local school district in which the facility is located. However, that impact on that local school district is out of their control, and therefore this program provides state resources to pay for the education while they're located in the facilities. This really is sort of a way to ensure that state action or local legal actions against children don't impact a particular school district unusually. And this provides us the resources to provide the education. We've ensured that the educational program, again, are provided by local contractors, either a local school district or an ESD, and that they provide a full educational opportunity for these children while they're in these facilities locally. We generate the dollars through the state school funds at a 1.5 weight. Again, we're ability to have a critical mass in order to provide efficiencies with the dollars are less we're less able to do that in these facilities because there's fewer kids. You still need numbers of adults to have either teachers and educational assistants so that the dollars spent are a little bit higher than what you'd experience in the local public school system. And with that, I would be glad to answer any questions the committee has.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon?
In the previous request, would you break that information out by race and ethnicity, gender, race, and ethnicity?
Madam Chair, Senator Gurley, we certainly will.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments?
Woo.
I worked hard at that.
Does this actually conclude the presentation? No. Mr. Greenfield.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
One
for
moment.
The
one moment. I have just been scoped in on the plan here, which is very
yes.
helpful.
For the record, Mike Greenfield, several more riveting presentations.
Are we in a place where we could use the last 15 minutes here, or do you have people in the room that can do this? Dave is the next stop.
Madam Chair, I believe that we can go through this in a fairly rapid way.
The body language is indicating readiness to me. So.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm Dave Fazier, Director of Management Services at the Oregon Department of Education, and on my right is Mark Hunt, Director of Human Resources. I haven't felt this rush since being in the Navy, and I'll see what I can do to expedite your time frame. This presentation is a conglomeration of leadership and central services organizational units. We've spent the last 2 weeks with you covering specific programs which are implemented and supported by the Department of Education. Now we'd like to cover with you your investment in the agency infrastructure, which supports all the agency activities, along with two small but important programs which are not organizationally assigned to one of the offices, those being private career schools and pupil transportation. The department's infrastructure in leadership and central services leverages Oregon's ability to represent birth through age 21 education programs and policy at the state and national levels, and in the state for 198 school districts, 21 ESDs, 1,200 schools, and each taxpayer and citizen. It leverages quality staffing and effective labor management practices, and leverages fiscal and ethical integrity in the expenditure of those funds. It consists of the organizational units you see on the slide. From this infrastructure flows the information and activities to ensure proper leadership and accountability at the agency and for education programs in Oregon. Properly led, organized, and managed, these units and the agency are the coalescing force for a well-run, efficient, and responsive public agency. Without the capacity to effectively provide vision, leadership, and support functions through these units, the agency of necessity dissolves into a series of standalone silos of operation, a condition some perceive that we are now recovering from. I'll go through each one of those units just briefly now. The first is State Board of Education. As you know, is our policymaking board. It consists of seven Oregonians, and it adopts standards for public schools. The members are appointed by the governor for up to 2 4-year terms, and they're unsalaried and cannot engage in school administration or teaching while they serve. This unit sustains or has two full-time equivalents supporting it. Next is the Office of the Superintendent. The Office of the Superintendent leads the constitutional mandate to provide by law for the establishment of a uniform and general system of common schools. They implement statewide standards for public schools. Birth through age 21 education programs in Oregon represent an enterprise activity of over $6 billion a biennium, and they have national significance and reputation. Next is communications and publications, primarily responsible for coordinating all the agency and program communications with the public and the media, and as you can see, consists of media and community relations, citizen information activities, agency website coordination, and agency publications coordination. We addressed the Quality Ed Commission during the state school fund hearings. This portion of the superintendent's office supports a one-half-time FTE and supplies support to that commission for their important work, which you see in the bullets on this slide. Next is policy and research. This unit is responsible for the production of the Oregon report card. The Oregon dropout report is the focal point for the superintendent for interpretation and implementation of No Child Left Behind. The federal liaison, contains the federal liaison that maintains ongoing communications with the U.S. Department of Education and Oregon congressional delegations, and conducts policy development and research. Next is the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board, established in statute. There is one half-time FTE that supports this effort. And with that, I'll pass the presentation over to Mark Hunt, Director of Human Resources.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will try to be expeditious as my counterpart here has been. For the record, I'm the Director of Human Resources and also Support Services for the Department of Education. An effective human resources unit is comprised of many interrelated functions intended to support and facilitate the mission of the agency. Some of these functions include personnel, payroll, benefits services, recruitment, security checks for our kids, affirmative action, classification issues, union negotiations, and workers' comp. Operationally, these functions are divided into three general areas, as you see on the slide: personnel services, payroll, and recruitment. Each of these activities are intended to support the organization's strategic objectives and missions. It is essential that we be flexible, enabling the organization to change in response to economic downturns or economic booms, we can all hope, changes in administration, demographic trends, technological changes, and skilled workforce shortages. The next slide. It was requested that information be provided concerning the span of control, that is, the ratio of supervising personnel to staff. There's no magical number that we can ascribe to this ratio. Experts will give you a variety of numbers. Where the work that's performed is generic or task-oriented, you would expect this span of control to be larger. Conversely, where the duties performed are highly technical or varied, that span of control is generally smaller. The information before you reflects the historical and projected ratios between staff and supervisors. This data shows a significant change over the past 10 years and deserves some explanation. The reasoning for the darker shaded areas during the 93 through 99 period, it's a bulge that in the graph that results from additional position authority that was associated with youth corrections and summer school programs. These numbers, for the most part, included positions that were unfilled or used as teacher substitutes, and the unused position authority related to the youth corrections program after the program activity had been transitioned to the Willamette ESD. These unused positions have since been eliminated from the agency's budgeted position authority, and our current span of control reflects the downward pressure from the agency's efforts to delegate or contract direct services outside of the department. For the support services, building the team is analogous to gathering the component parts for a building project. It takes a diversity of components to be successful. Support services, like human resources, when it is working well, generally goes unnoticed and is transparent to the casual observer. These functions support organizational performance and reflect the organization's strategic objectives. Key elements include student records, archiving, facility leases and contracts, services to provide a safe work environment, mail services, and connectivity for technology and telephone. At this point, I'll turn it back over to Mr. Fazier to continue.
Thank you. Continuing with the transparent efforts inside the agency, those efforts that when properly done nobody recognizes, but when they're not, everyone knows. The accounting unit is the fiscal leg of our accountability and cash and fund management. Travel liquidation does invoice processing and payment services. They log upwards of 400,000 transactions into the state accounting system of biennium and work on the activities that you see on the slide. Next is the budget unit. Budget unit develops and oversees implementation of the biennial budget plan that you provide for us, maintains statewide budget systems, does technical assistance in training, and does forecasting and analysis for the agency and other users. Next is the procurement unit. Procurement is our primary tool of accountability. It provides a formal fair process of procuring services and supplies from the local sector, ensures integrity and ethical processes in handling the 7,000-plus contracts and the 4,000-plus purchase orders processed biennially. They maintain the contract management system. They provide training and oversee the newly developed procurement certification program at the agency, and they maintain agency delegation of authority status. Next, private career schools. This office is responsible for oversight of all non-degree granting career schools, and additionally, the office is the state approving agency for veterans administration programs. Next, pupil transportation is responsible for administering the certification of all school bus and school activity drivers, monitors all pupil transportation vehicles for construction standards and ongoing safe operations, and conducts background checks for prospective employees and volunteers, and processes fingerprints for all classified employees. And finally, a brief slide on state government service charges and the general fund and other fund breakdown that we use to pay for those services. And with that, Madam Chair, that is a very brief, expeditious overview of leadership and central services. I'd be happy to answer any
questions or comments. Representative March.
Mr. Fager, what is the connection, and it looks like maybe a little overlap in work between the research staff you've got in the superintendent's office and the assessment section? Because they're both reporting on, because during that testimony we heard a lot about the Oregon report card and other reports. So
the policy and research unit has the people that actually coalesce all of the information and work with everyone in the agency to produce the report. So the assessment office maintains a majority of that data, and they maintain the data. The office is the central focal point for bringing that and other information and communication together to produce the report.
Okay.
You look like you need a follow-up.
Well, I was just trying to. What FTE would you say goes into those reports, the report card and the dropout report?
Madam Chair, Representative March, I would like an opportunity to get back to you with that information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Yeah, just curious about the history of the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board in its placement at the Department of Education versus being a part of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I do know that the Fair Dismissal Law was enacted by the Legislative Assembly in 1971. It replaced the Teacher Tenure Law and established the board. I don't have any information on why those activities are only conducted or are conducted at the department versus any other agency. But I can get that information and get it to you by the end of the day.
Committee, we're up against our time limit here. We still have a discussion of the vacancy list, which I'm not sure where it's going to be on this. It has arrows and things written all over here. And we also have of the priority list, the performance measures, and, a few more items left in your presentation. The committee, what I'll do is close the public hearings on House Bill 5014 and 5015. I will recess this subcommittee meeting, and we will reconvene at 1 p.m. this afternoon in Hearing Room 170, not this room, in 170, to conclude the presentation.
Thank you. 1 o'clock. Thank you.